This is first cases 67519, Hart versus State. Mr. Petty, on behalf of the appellants, if you wish to reserve any time, please so state.
Good morning, Justice Douglas, Justice Gibbons, Justice Cherry. May it please the court. I'm John Petty. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Hart, and I'd like to reserve 4 minutes. I'm going to try and keep track of my time here.
Thank you.
As relevant here, Mr. Hart and his co-defendants, Letitia Babb and Weston Syrox, were indicted, tried by a jury, and convicted of murder with the use of a deadly weapon and robbery with the use of a deadly weapon. At that time, they were all facing the death penalty, but only Mr. Hart received the death penalty. The other individuals received sentences of life without the possibility of parole on the murder charge with a consecutive enhancement, and then a term of months for the robbery with a consecutive enhancement. After this court issued its opinion in McConnell, the district court held a hearing, and at that hearing determined that because the only aggravating circumstance that applied to Mr. Hart, or that had been charged against Mr. Hart and found by the jury, was robbery in the course of a murder, under this court's opinion in McConnell, the district court vacated the death penalty and set a new penalty hearing. This court, on an appeal from the state, affirmed, and ultimately that penalty hearing was held last year in late January, early February of 2015. That penalty hearing took 6 days. There were a variety of witnesses called on behalf of the state, and Mr. Hart testified, and Mr. Hart presented evidence on his own behalf. The jury at that penalty hearing ultimately concluded that the appropriate sentence would be life without the possibility of parole plus a consecutive weapon enhancement, and the court had already imposed a term of months on the robbery. We are here to ask that you vacate that sentence and remand for a new sentencing hearing based on two substantive grounds, and then, of course, a third reason being that given the circumstances of this case and given the character of Mr. Hart, as it has grown over the 15 years plus that he's been in prison, that the penalty of life without the possibility of parole was excessive. The first substantive reason that the court should entertain our request to vacate the sentence below is that during the sentencing hearing, the district court granted the state's motion to admit evidence to before this new sentencing jury regarding the sentences that had been received by the co-defendants, Ms. Babb and Ms. Syrox. We submit that that was error because, first I should tell you, the reasoning that the court gave for that, first she said that under NRS 175.552 subsection 3, it was relevant as it constituted other matter which the court deems relevant to the sentence, whether or not it was ordinarily admissible. She reasoned, and this is a paraphrase, and you can find this at page 51 in volume 1 of the joint appendix. She reasoned, first, all three defendants participated in the criminal exercise, but it was Mr. Hart that had actually shot the victim. All three defendants were convicted in the district court of the murder. The circumstances of the offense involved unequal participation between Mr. Hart and his co-defendants. And then this is a quote, thus, the sentence of the unequally culpable co-defendants are relevant, proper, and helpful for the jury in considering the circumstances of the offense for which Mr. Hart has been convicted. But why? That's the question. Why? Those sentences were informed by the death sentence that Mr. Hart received. They were tried together. Mr. Hart, they all faced the death penalty at the same time. Mr. Hart is the only defendant who was sentenced to death, and the other two were given sentences of life without the possibility of parole. We know now, based on this court's decision in McConnell, that the aggravating circumstance that Mr. Hart faced was an invalid aggravating circumstance, and that the case should not have been tried, at least as alleged at that time, as a death penalty case. The question is, had the case been tried as a non-capital murder, what would the sentences have been that would have been imposed against Mr. Hart or against his co-defendants? But the salient point here is, because those sentences of life without the possibility of parole were informed, they're stepped-down sentences from the death penalty that could have been sought and was actually imposed by Hart. They're influenced by the death penalty that Mr. Hart received. The reliability as a sentencing factor, we think, is questionable. Moreover, we think that the opinion by Justice Rose in the first Flanagan case, which held and analyzed a variety of cases from different jurisdictions, that the sentences received by co-defendants is not relevant at a penalty hearing for a defendant because it does not play upon that individual character of the defendant, and it does not go to the circumstances of the offense, and should be inadmissible.
Mr. Petty, you know, I understand your argument and the one Justice Rose made. What if, hypothetically, in this case, these co-defendants had received sentences of life with the possibility of parole, and now you're facing Mr. Hart on the remand after the McConnell case came down? Would the defense have sought to get that into evidence?
Sure they would have, Your Honor.
Yeah. So how do we reconcile that? Because we have to, you know, sometimes it may help you, sometimes it may hurt you. So if we're going to enunciate a rule, if we're going to change it and maybe go along with what Justice Rose suggested, could it be a problem for the defense as well?
It might be. I think in my brief I suggested that the court should be prepared to say, regardless of who offers it, whether it's the defense or the prosecution, that the sentence of a co-defendant in a murder penalty hearing is not relevant. So to answer your question, if I was a district court judge making that decision, I would tell the defense, no, that's not relevant. We're going to proceed with regards to the crime itself and the character of this particular
crime. So you would just say it's not permitted either way?
In a murder penalty hearing, it's not permitted either way, yes. In fact, just to turn your question around a little bit, I dropped a footnote, I think it was in my reply brief, that had it been the case that Ms. Babb and Mr. Cyrix had received a sentence of life with the possibility of parole, that you can be sure the state would not have been seeking to have that introduced.
And I
suspect that had defense moved to admit that kind of evidence, they would have objected vociferously. So my conclusion is that it just shouldn't come in a penalty hearing. I would note that in the majority opinion, if this helps you come to my side of the position, in the majority opinion, the case that was cited by the majority, State v. McKinney, did not deal with this issue. That was not an issue before the court at that time. All that happened in that case was the defendant complained that it was unfair that he got the death penalty while his co-defendant, a person named Debbie Small, got a life sentence. And all the court there said was that, well, different culpability justifies different kinds of sentences. And as a general proposition, I would say that's true. But because these life without sentences were informed by Mr. Hart's death penalty, because of the unique circumstances of this case, it should never have come in. And the fact, you know that it had an impact because the jury was only out less than 2 hours. The jury, if you look at the court minutes, which is part of the certificate sent up by the court clerk, if you look at the court minutes for the sixth day, the jury went out at 11:43 in the morning, and then the court reconvened at 11:51 that afternoon. We know, because we've been in district court trials, that when a jury tells the bailiff or whomever they report, we have a verdict. It takes a while to get everybody back to the courtroom to receive that verdict from the jury. So from 11:43 to 1:52, I think, was the entire time that they deliberated. After a six-day penalty hearing, you have to presume that evidence, the fact that these co-defendants who were not the shooter got a life without, influenced the jury here. Why should we give this shooter a sentence less than what they received? The second issue that we raised for a reason to give a second or a new penalty hearing is just the structure of the arguments that was given at the hearing below. It was established before the evidence was admitted that the state had no burden whatsoever in a penalty hearing. They didn't have to prove anything beyond a reasonable doubt or by clear and convincing evidence or even by a preponderance of the evidence. All they had was a burden of persuasion, which the defense had too, a burden of persuasion. The state had the burden of trying to persuade the jury that the appropriate penalty would be life without the possibility of parole. The defense, because they were not seeking the term of year sentence and said so directly to the jury, they had the burden of persuasion to convince the jury to impose a sentence of life with the possibility of parole. The argument that was made below and rejected by the district court was each side should be able to make their argument and then the matter be submitted to the jury. The court ruled that the prosecution got to make an opening close, the defense would make their close, and then the prosecution got a final close. But there's no statutory authority for that. And the case that was cited by the prosecution below, Scholes v. State, is in a posit because that was a death penalty case. And in a death penalty case, the state does have a burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and that is as to aggravators. In Scholes, they didn't meet that burden, but they did have that burden. So Scholes doesn't apply here.
The persuasion, as you speak of it, in an ordinary trial, the state has opens and closes. Why is this not considered the extension of a trial since it's no longer a capital situation?
Because NRS 175.141, which speaks to the process of trial, how it shall take place, is specific to the trial process and does not mention the penalty phase.
Well, this is no longer a true penalty phase because penalty phase is only for death. This is a trial or a continuation of a trial now. So
it's not, Your Honor. It's a sentencing hearing. That's all it is. It's a sentencing hearing.
We have to put it in either box one or box two. You're attempting to create a box three. So tell me how you would create your box three.
Well, Justice Tuggles, I don't believe I'm creating a box three. I think that I'm staying right within the ordinary playing field. You have in capital cases and in certain Class A categories where the jury sentences, you have a bifurcated proceeding. You have the guilt phase, and then you have the sentencing phase. But the guilt phase is a stage where, in non-capital cases, the state has the burden of proof. At the sentencing phase, it's just a question of persuasion. Now, the court may want, and the parties may wish, to call witnesses to present their respective cases. But when it comes to arguing their points, it's just a matter of persuasion. And we think that by giving the state two arguments in this instance, basically, place the thumb on the scale in favor of the state, just as allowing the co-defendant sentences into evidence place the thumb on the scale of justice, if you will, in favor of the prosecution, which we think is fundamentally unfair. And for those reasons, we request this court to vacate and remand for a new penalty hearing.
Don't you think that's something the legislature should handle rather than us?
No. Justice Cherry, in fact, I would say that because 175.141 speaks to the trial process and the legislature could have added to that statute to address the penalty phase itself but did not, this court has all the discretion and the power that it needs to make a determination that in non-capital sentencing penalty hearings before a jury, it's a question of persuasion. And therefore, the structure shall be each side gets to make an argument.
Mr. Petty, you're at 2:15 at this
point. Thank you. I'll reserve my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Mr. McCarthy.
Good morning, Justices of the Supreme Court. I'm Terry McCarthy, Deputy District Attorney from Washoe County, on behalf of the state. There were one or two little things to add to the procedural history. One is there were competing motions on the subject of the sentences on the co-defendants. That is, the prosecutor had made a motion to allow the evidence, and the defense had filed pretty much simultaneously a competing motion to exclude it. So it was thoroughly considered by the district court. The other is, this jury was well instructed on the limitations of this evidence, and there's no evidence of any improper argument. So, you know, in the second Flanagan case, and this court said that this evidence is admissible. It is my position and we can continue to follow that case. But two, I think it went too far. That is, the proper analysis is that this evidence, like all evidence, is addressed to the sound discretion of the trial court. Let me give an example of where we go, how things go wrong when we go too far. There's been a long series of cases, beginning with, I think it was McMichael, and ending with Bronstein, about prior sexual conduct of a person on trial for some sort of sexual misconduct. And for quite a few years, the court had said, oh, yeah, sure, it's admissible. And then finally he said, well, wait, it's not that it's admissible. It's not inadmissible. That's the difference. So you see, a hard and fast rule saying this evidence is or is not admissible is the wrong way to go. Instead, we should recognize that a district court has all sorts of discretion to consider, among other things, the risk of confusion of the issues and undue waste of time and the like.
What would have happened, Mr. McCarthy, on that hypothetical, if the co-defendants had had life with the possibility of parole? It sounds like under Flanagan, the defense would be saying, let's admit it, you would object to it, you know, like because it was a lesser penalty. It creates this inconsistencies with the district courts on how they treat the state versus the defense. If you have a hard and fast rule, then everybody's treated the same. So I think that's Mr. Petty's point. Why is he wrong on that?
I think it is unwise to seek out a certain type of evidence and say this part, this bit, is treated differently than all others.
Should we have a different rule for non-capital and capital murders?
No, I don't think so. I imagine the interests of the parties would vary some, but the determination of the district judge, I think, would pretty much be the same. I would think that in most cases you would have what I'll call the can of worms test, that allowing this is going to open a can of worms to responsive evidence, explaining the differences.
I think about the Curtis Guy case, where Curtis Guy was not the shooter. The shooter got life with a deal, and then Curtis got death. And I'm not sure in that particular case, that was a number of years ago, whether they even tried to put in evidence that the shooter got life. But I know there was a case that Justice Pickering and I think dissented on. It was a death penalty case where the defense did want to put in evidence of the co-defendant sentence.
There have been other cases before this court going both ways.
And I know. That's the problem. I think it's time that we make a rule. I'm sorry this is an en banc, to tell you the truth. I think that we need to make a rule on this, because I had, as a special public defender, had a number of murder cases where the sentences were varied as to various defendants. Mm-hmm. And at least Justice Pickering and I, on the case we had, which I'm not sure was an order or a opinion, felt that the jury should have all the information when it comes to sentencing.
The general rule is, yes, we should give jury and sentencing judge as much information as possible and allow them to consider it as they will. I disagree with the notion that we ought to make a rule. I don't think that we should. I think we have them. The rules in the evidence code.
But when you're in the trenches, you sure would like rules, whether you're a prosecutor or a defense attorney.
I agree with that.
I mean, it makes it much easier for everybody if we had a rule. Yes, you can have evidence in capital and non-capital cases of co-defendant sentences. And, you know, you have to beware if you're the defense attorney and the sentence is different. You're taking your chances. Same thing with the prosecutor. You're taking your chances. But either that's the rule or it isn't the rule. It never comes in or it always comes in.
If you're suggesting that a definitive ruling from this court will stop the argument, it won't. When the defense has the evidence excluded, then they will say that as a matter of due process, I'm required to have it, regardless of the prior decisions of this
court.
When
I first looked at this case, I thought your positions would be opposite, to tell you the truth.
My position is that it was not error. My position is not that we should have a rule that either allows or excludes this evidence in all cases. Now, I think that my position is we already have a rule, and that rule is in the evidence code, and you're right. It would be easier if we had special rules for certain types of evidence. It has always proven to be unwise when we do that. Now, I agree that it would be easier, but that's why we get the big bucks here. Oh, wait, we don't. I agree. It would be easier, but that's not the test. There are some things that require a hard and fast rule, a black letter rule, so to speak, but this is not one of them. Instead, we should trust our district court judges to consider that which should be considered, to disregard that which should be disregarded, and then make a decision.
See, this case is a little different because in the original trial, he gets death, and the co-defendants get the life without. If it had been, if the McConnell rule had been in effect where they were only asking for life without for him, and they found out the other guys might have gotten life with.
You know, there's, I think that is incorrect supposition. Yeah. If McConnell rule had been in effect, this would have been a death penalty case. It would have been charged differently. You may recall in the last appeal involved whether or not we could have a do-over. And it was my position then that we should be allowed to amend the charging instrument to take out the felony murder and try this fellow again. And the court said, no, that's not the remedy for the McConnell error.
Right.
But the record at that time, which is still before the court, certainly would have allowed that if the McConnell rule had been enforced at the time. So the supposition that this would not have been a death penalty case is incorrect. I believe it would have been. It certainly could have been.
What about the issue of the state opening and closing with the defense in the middle? Should it be the same for capital and non-capital murder cases?
I think, once again, I think that the court has broad discretion here. My primary position is the statute does apply because it's a part of the trial. Certainly it's a critical stage of the prosecution or whatever other term we wish to use, but I think it's part of the trial. The legislature probably intended to make it part of the trial. If not, if that statute doesn't apply, that doesn't mean that you have to choose. I mean, I really don't know how many district court judges we have in Muni Court and JPs, but I suspect they all go differently in regular sentencing hearings, and I don't know why it would be different because there's a jury there. I mean, some judges have the defendant make his allocution first. Some judges have the allocution last. Some judges say the prosecution can go first and last. Some do it differently. The point is that judges can decide. If there's no statute that controls, then judges can decide. And of course, even if I'm wrong, there is a question of prejudice, a supposition that a properly instructed jury would have returned a different verdict if only somebody else had the last word it's a little too speculative for my taste. So I would urge the court to make no ruling at all on that subject and just recognize that the courts do things differently. Every judge does it differently, and it's not a problem. So if there had been an actual demonstration of bias, that's an entirely different question. But there wasn't one. The judge just had to choose how we're going to do the arguments. That judge chose to do the way she always does it. So it's not significant. And so I guess to summarize, there ought not to be a hard and fast rule on either one of these issues. We should leave it to the district court judges to consider all that should be considered and to disregard all that should be disregarded and then defer to the district court.
Well, the nice thing is you got three former district court judges from Clark County, and we did a lot of sentencing when we were there the number of years we were all there. It'll be interesting to hear my colleagues when we have conferences to. Sometimes they let the defendant talk last. Sometimes they let the state talk last. Sometimes they cut everybody off because there's been enough is enough. So I'm anxious to hear when we conference on this, what everybody's going to say.
If I were a betting man, I'd bet you were all different.
Well, that may be the issue, you know, Mr. McCarthy. I don't know if the district judges, some may like the hard rules because that way it's easier for them to run the trial, saying here's the rule from the Supreme Court or the legislature, versus judges having inconsistent approaches. I don't know. It's a philosophical thing.
I think that if one goes looking for a rule, they can certainly rely on the statute and say that this is part of the trial.
Let me ask you this. If we did adopt a firm rule, and we haven't even talked about it, so I don't know what's going to happen, yes. But if we did adopt a firm rule, would you rather have all the sentences in or all of them out if you had to make a choice, you know, of the two? Mr. Petty says that his choice would be exclude them all, you know, like that for the co-defendants. What would you say?
Well, I would say in most cases, proportionality is an appropriate consideration. Mm-hmm. There are times when that opens the can of worms. There, you know, I don't remember if Rodriguez was published or not. That was maybe 6 months ago in this court. And in that case, in the trial stage, two defendants were sentenced to death. One of them got it reversed because he was too young. Then one of them had a new sentencing hearing later on. And I said, well, how are we going to explain that to the jury? So allowing the proportionality analysis in that case would have opened up a can of worms. It would have, that's right, one of them was sentenced by a three-judge panel, so not by a jury. So the differences were too great. Here, no one suggested that allowing this is going to require separate trials or a great deal of additional evidence, or that it would confuse the issues or anything else. It is, when those things exist, that's what the judge should consider. But there was no suggestion of that in this case, and so, you know, a few seconds of evidence, an instruction that they don't have to follow that, but you can certainly consider for what it's worth. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But I would recommend against the hard and fast rule because sometimes it's going to be wrong. Sometimes, like we had in the line of cases with the sexual misconduct. You know, first it was always admissible, then it was always inadmissible, and then we have a case where motive is an element, and that makes it all different. The right rule is the one in the evidence code, and that is considered all the various factors that ought to be considered. And as is my custom, I still have time, but I'm done talking here. Thank you.
Thank you. I like rules. And I also am a very pragmatic person, I think. Justice Chair, you said you thought maybe our positions would be completely opposite. I would be saying, Your Honors, you've got to let these co-defendant sentences in because sometimes my capital defendant is facing a sentence where the co-defendants have gotten something less, life with or life without. We've got to be able to do that. And as a practical matter, I would say absolutely we should do that. But the fact is, if you look at the cases that were cited by Justice Rose in his concurring opinion in Flanagan, and if you go to just a cursory review of jurisdictions that have considered this issue, my reading of those cases is that when the defendant wants to get that information in because they are lesser sentences, it's almost always, if not always, no, it's not relevant. But if the state wants to get the information in, then it's relevant because it goes to the nature of the crime and the character of the defendant. So the state wins, defense always loses. If that's the game, then I want a rule that says nobody gets that benefit, period. When Mr. McCarthy says we should leave it up to the discretion of the judge, I submit, and I put this in my brief, that's just code for it's always going to come in if the state requests it, but it mean almost always will never come in if the defense requests it. So I would ask for a rule that says it doesn't come in. There is, and to the extent that the Mr. McCarthy mentioned the argument, if you turn to Volume 7 at page 946, this is what the prosecutor said. Quote, he had mentioned what the co-defendant's sentences were. And then he says, quote, remember that when you were trying to figure out what is a fair, appropriate, and just sentence for Sean Hart, who pulled the trigger and shot Mr. Castro. Then he told the jury, you're not bound by the prior sentences, but you may, and he highlighted this, consider the sentence of Weston Cyrex and Letitia Babb when determining what is fair and appropriate for this man. So basically what he says is, if Babb and Cyrex got life without, ladies and gentlemen, this jury, why would you give the shooter a sentence of life with? If that didn't influence their decision, I don't know what. I don't know how you can say it did not. Thank you.
Thank you. As always, Mr. Petty, Mr. McCarthy, very good arguments. We appreciate it. This matter will stand submitted.